This program was first broadcast on Arrow FM, Wairarapa's only community access media station, and shared on Access Media with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora. You're listening to Film Talks On Air. I'm your host, Jane Ross. Joining me in the studio today is Mark Pacey. Kia ora. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you.
It is wonderful to have you here. We have some exciting news, and I personally can't wait to dive into what that exciting news is, but I think I'm going to start by asking you to just to tell us a little about yourself. So, Mark, you live in Masterton. What do you do here?
I work at the Wairarapa Archive. I am the local heritage specialist. To put that in simple terms, I'm the guy that takes what we have in the archive and gets it back out into the community, whether it's through writing articles for the newspaper or books or going out and giving presentations, making what we've got digestible in small bites, concentrated efforts, so people can enjoy our history without having to necessarily delve through hundreds of pages of historical records.
I absolutely love what you do. I love reading your stories in the local newspapers as well. I've been to your presentations. They're really engaging. Are there particular parts of our local history that really interest you?
Two of them spring to mind. So the shipwreck thing sort of took off around COVID, and that just became bigger and bigger. That's what I was known for a while. And then since then, it has been about the when the Americans stayed here. That was 5 years ago, and I'm still heavily involved in what they did and who they were.
So you've published books about both of these topics. The first one was about the shipwrecks of the Wairarapa region in particular, around the coastlines. Fascinating, fascinating stories. And the second, I think we're going to hone in on this topic. So tell me a little bit more about the Marines that came to live in Masterton. What was the context for this?
So this was in February of 1943. So the Marines that came here, they'd been on Guadalcanal. They'd been on Guadalcanal for 6 months. And when you look at photos of Guadalcanal today, it looks quite nice. But then it was, you know, it was a horrible place. You had an extremely determined enemy that refused to give up, refused to surrender. You had a lack of supplies. Most of them had malaria towards the end there. So after 6 months on this island, they were absolutely exhausted. They were not in any condition to be fighting. Before they were on Guadalcanal, a bunch of them were at Midway Atoll when that was attacked on June 4th, 1942, if I get my facts right. And then before that, they happened to be at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. So they'd been through the ringer. They'd been through all of these things. And it was felt at that point they need to get away from the front lines. They need to basically get healthy again because some of them were sick and exhausted. Let's send them as far away from the front lines as we can without sending them back to America. And they chose little old Masterton as a place that's about as far away from the war as you can get, where they can be isolated and just get back to being young men again and then get into retraining.
I can't possibly imagine what that was like for the Marines, but actually also what that was like for the people of Masterton. So that is a huge story to tell. How long did you spend researching this topic?
I started researching it before the COVID lockdown. So that was
2001.
February 2000. And
no, 2020.
It was, yeah, so it was about January or February of 2020.
Wow.
I started researching this. For a few years, I released the book on February 17, 2023. So that's just the book.
Okay.
And then,
and that's just the book, so yeah. We're leading into our big announcement,
well,
aren't we?
Well, there's a couple. So that was the first bit. The second bit, because this is a horrifying fact, not everybody reads books anymore.
Mm.
So even months or a year after I'd done the book, people are still saying, I had no idea the Marines were here. You're like, oh, no. Let's make something really obvious that people will stop and look at. So I thought, well, let's build a memorial of sorts.
Mm.
And initially I started with a plaque on the ground. I was like, no, people will walk over it. If they don't mow the lawns, it'll be growing over. Let's make it bigger. So I designed it in the American style, big, about 8 foot tall, expecting the showgrounds and the AMP Society to go, it's too big, make it smaller. And in the end they actually said, no, that's brilliant, make it. So that was the next one. That was the project for 2024, was building a war memorial to the Marines that were there. And even then, I was like, well, it's interesting. And being the diligent historian that I am, I recorded every step of making the memorial with my camera. So I filmed it all. And I thought, well, this could be interesting. Another way of telling people this story about the Marines, let's do a documentary. I've always wanted to do a documentary. So let's do a documentary about who the Marines were, where they came from, what they did when they were here, and when they left, and how the memorial came about, how I built it, how I installed it, and the unveiling of it and the speeches and things involved around that. Bring the two together to form one really interesting documentary, I hope.
So we get the absolute pleasure at the Wairarapa Film Festival of having the world premiere of Never Forgotten, The Marines of Masterton. Congratulations, Mark.
Thank you.
This has been epic because you gave me a call just after the film festival last year. So this conversation and all the work has been happening for the past year. We've checked in on regular intervals. We've talked about all kinds of things like royalty-free music and censorship and getting permissions and even interview styles and techniques. And it's been a remarkable journey to walk with you. You have done a magnificent job. You've worked so hard. I said to you from the start, if anyone's going to do this, it's going to be you, and you've done it, and congratulations.
Thank you.
How does it feel?
Pretty good, actually. It was a bit tense leading up to the deadline.
Indeed.
I was naive, thinking I could hand it in on the night of the showing, not thinking that the cinema has to check the files, work in the sound. I didn't think of that. I was like, you know, like the Peter Jacksons of the world, here it is. It's an hour before showing. We finally finished it. So the deadline shifted back a little bit. I'd been on holiday in America for 3.5 weeks, right around the time that it would have been great to be doing editing.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that time was obviously I can't do editing. So I crammed in a lot of post-production into a very short period of time, which involved some very late nights. I haven't had a day off pretty much since I've come back from holiday, Saturdays, Sundays, all the way through working until sort of 19 o'clock at night each day. But we did it.
So well, you did it. Yeah. And I know it was me putting those deadlines on to you and giving you that time frame of what needed to happen. But I knew that you'd do it. I knew. And if you could see that this is what needed to happen in these time frames, I knew that you would rise to the occasion. And like all good artists and filmmakers, I think a really good friend of mine, Christian Nicholson, said it's never a Christian Nicholson exhibition if you don't have a painting on the wall with paint that's still drying. So, but yes, I have just been into the Regent as we speak to actually do the test watch of the film, and it's magnificent.
You've seen it?
I've seen it this morning.
Oh, so it works.
It works. Yay. So there's the good news for our listeners. I got to watch the first 30 minutes. I've got to go back and this is something that I always do. This is good for listeners to know that whenever somebody hands in a film, there's always got to be a quality control test to make sure that the sound and the picture quality are very good for our audience, and that it's consistent all the way through. So I've begun doing that. And I do that for every film. This being your debut film and the world premiere, then I really want to make sure that this is a great experience for everybody. And for you, Mark, you know, this is actually making sure that we're honouring you and the really hard work that you've put in. And I'm going to say for the last 5 years, I've actually been getting to the point of telling the story in the written form, but also now visually. Yeah. Now, there's been a lot of local people involved in the making of this documentary too. So tell us about some of the key people.
Because I knew from the beginning I didn't want it to be just me. I watch as many documentaries as I do movies.
Mm-hmm.
I love my documentaries. Some are done really well. Some are like, the ones that I find the least engaging are where it's one person presenting and they tell you everything. They do all the historical stuff, all the background, they do it all. I don't like that, and I never wanted to do that. So I thought, well, let's involve as many other people in it as we can. If there's someone who knows more about World War II, like my friend Peter Cook in Wellington,
mm-hmm.
that's what he does. He's a military historian. I was like, better him tell everyone the story of New Zealand's involvement up till Pearl Harbor in World War II than me. So I asked him, and he was absolutely generous. He said, yeah, absolutely. So I went down to Wellington and I interviewed him and used him for that. I've got another friend, Brooke, in Featherston, who knows a lot about munitions and guns and bullets and things. There were a few bullets that were found when the ground was being developed, where the barracks is now, which started this whole thing. And I thought, well, again, I could go online and go for Google images and potentially find out what these are. But it's better when you have an expert who knows these rounds, who have, you know, used those firearms to say, this is from this gun, this is from this gun, trying to get as many sort of expert voices in there as we can. And then also having a bit of fun with some of the dialogue as well, because there's a lot of written accounts, a lot of quotes from people that were around at the time. And you can't just put text up and have people read it. That's boring. I don't want to do that. I also didn't want me to read it out. So in the end, I thought, well, here's all the roles that I need to fill. You know, I need someone who's grumpy about the traffic and someone who's complaining about the theatres being, you know, playing the American national anthem and, you know, all of those different roles. I was like, well, let's get actual different people to speak all of those roles. And luckily, with a lot of the Marine roles and the American roles, you want American voices. We could put on a fake American voice, but they would spot it a mile away, much like when they do a New Zealand or an Australian accent. You're like, that's not an Australian accent.
No.
Let's go authentic. I've got a few American friends now that I've built up over the last few years, and I asked a lot of them, and pretty much all of them said, yeah, happy to do it. So they provided the American voices. So we've got genuine American voices doing American voices.
I really love your dedication to telling this story. And tell me a little bit more about the choices that you made. I've kind of just picking up on an early definition of documentary film is the creative treatment of actuality. So a documentary is probably my favorite genre. And I like it because it is about something that really happened. It's about real people and it's about real events and real places. So this is certainly a very much a local story, and I'm really pleased that we've got a local, a truly Masterton story premiering right here in Masterton. Some of the creative processes that go into making a documentary involve, for example, the use of music. What did you do about getting your soundtrack sorted?
There was always a song that I always wanted to use from a New Zealand band called Shepherd's Rain. Ah. They're from Auckland. They're sort of Polynesian metal, I think is how they describe themselves. And they've got quite a diverse sound. But there was one song in particular called Never Forgotten. And just the name alone, I was like, that really resonates. I like that. So I use that name as the name of the documentary because it's perfect. This documentary is so people don't forget who they were. It also gets kind of heavy. It gets into sort of the more metal stuff, which I like as well. I thought, well, it'd be great to use the song that inspired the name of the film as the closing credits, because that's where your big song is. It's the closing credits song. So I got in touch with them, and they actually emailed back, which surprised me because most people, you never hear from them. Mm. And they were really generous and said, absolutely, you can use it. Go for it. So that was the end credit one. But throughout it, there's also a few poignant moments where you want some quiet sort of scores. So tried to actually had a chat with you about the royalty-free music that you can get. Found a website called Artlist, I think it's called. Subscribe to that. And there's a lot of music on there. Any genre, any type you can think of is on there. Of course, I was leaning heavily towards the sort of Hans Zimmer style with the quiet sweeping scores of the string sections. Found a heap of them. I only ended up using about three, I think. But they underline what's happening. And there is one scene, which you haven't seen yet towards the end, where there's no dialogue. It's all just scenes and music. That's it. I thought, well, instead of me talking over it, explaining what it is, let's just have the scenes and the music tell the story. And it creates
a montage?
Sort of. It's 7 or 8 scenes.
Mm-hmm.
Of stuff that I filmed when I was in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
So that book ends the thing quite nicely. I don't want to spoil it for you.
You're on the cusp of that.
It's right at the very, very end is that, but it's one of the last scenes I use. But it bookends it really, really nicely and ties it back to something that's on the memorial that I built as well.
Fantastic. There were also chats that you and I had around a particular style of interviewing and presenting information. Tell me about who your inspiration was for this documentary?
I mean, apart from you.
Thank you. I'll take that. I guess when you've looked at other documentaries, I mean, I herded you off to look at different documentaries that I love, to look at different styles, but there was always a particular British person from an acting background whose style that you really liked.
Eventually, maybe if I do a few more of these, I might be as good as Tony Robinson.
That's the one.
Who people know as Baldrick.
Yes.
But also they may know him as the presenter of Time Team. And he never just stands there and talks to the camera. He moves. He does, just the way he presents is so engaging. So I tried to do a little bit of that. There's a couple of scenes where I'm on site and I'm talking to the camera and I'm trying to do what he does. Unfortunately, the day that we actually went to do that, it was pouring with rain. It was a miserable. It looks brilliant on screen with all the raindrops coming down and dripping off me.
Yeah.
So it's quite appropriate, but it was a miserable shoot. But yeah, so I tried to emulate some of what he did. I know what I feel works really, really well, and I try to, you know, be influenced from those sorts of sources.
Fantastic. I was thinking about your style of documentary filmmaking, and I would call it participatory. And a participatory style of documentary filmmaking, and excuse me, but ever the teacher. I started off as a teacher, and it always comes through. But participatory is where the filmmaker's presence becomes in front of the camera and very well known, but you work in a partnership with a community of local knowledgeable people on a subject, but also people that you've engaged with to help you tell the story. So it's very much that, isn't it? This for you was very much a community project, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Like I said, I didn't want it to be just me talking to the camera for, what is it, an hour and 40 minutes, I think it turned out to be. If I saw someone else doing that, I would lose interest. So I tried, I should have researched this. It's either Peter Jackson or James Cameron said, I make the movies that I want to watch myself.
Brilliant.
So I've taken that same thing. I've made the documentary that I would want to watch in the style and in that style. So, yeah, like I said, it's not just me. If I can get someone else to talk about that thing, I will, as much as I possibly can. And it's amazing how many people are like, yeah, I'll do that. Even some of the things, because there's a sequence in there that's it's definitely comedic. It's a bit odd, but it's entertaining. Some of the things that I asked people to do in that were very odd. And it's amazing how many of them were still keen as like, yes, I will. Let me know. Tell me where you want me and how to do it, and I will do that for you.
I think that's one of the joyous things about being a filmmaker is that when you approach someone, and I've done this with you, Mark, and you ask them to do something that might be a little bit out of the box, isn't it incredible when people rise to that occasion?
It is. I mean, there's the people that are more out there, and you can generally work out who they are pretty quickly. If you've worked with them for a little while, you're like, yeah, they would possibly do that. And then there's the others that are a bit more reserved and might not do that, but might offer their voice to a role. So they're just a voice role only. You'll have some archival footage or something over the top and you'll have their voice underneath. So there's the two sides of it. But yeah, it's been really fun to work with other people and then seeing it all come together and seeing their bit in there is brilliant. I think they're going to get a bit of a kick out of how it's turned out.
One of the really important things about telling our stories is how powerful it is to be able to relate to what you see on a screen. And it was great for me to be able to see this film this morning and be able to go, oh, that's the guy from Sacred Tattoo Art. and there's the library, and you know, and it was just wonderful not only to see people but actually to see locations. So I think you've done something really special for the good people of Masterton, Wairarapa, in telling the story. You're telling our story.
Yeah. And it's because these people I know. I didn't just approach random people and said, do you want to be in it? I know all of these people, and like I said, you can kind of work out which ones are going to be keen to be involved in this thing. And like I said, some of the things I asked some of them to do is just, yeah. Like I said, Jordan from Sacred Art, you've seen him once. Wait till you see him the second time.
Oh, really?
A whole lot different. He's like, yep, I'll do that. So it's been brilliant don't like using this word, but to give back to the community. It's great because they've helped me out in one way or another over the last sort of 7-8 years that I've been working at the archive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cool little shout out to them. Say, well, I'll put you in my film, even for a little bit, but I'll put you in there.
Fabulous. We have the world premiere screening at Regent 3 Cinemas. Now, tell me why it was important to you to screen at the Regent.
First of all, I'm a traditionalist. I like the old style cinema. You know, the basic chairs, the popcorn. Sometimes there's a sticky floor. You know, that's a cinema. I've been to a few fancier ones. When I was in America, actually, we went to see a movie. And the chairs that you sit in have buttons, and you push the buttons, and it automatically reclines you. That's a little bit too fancy. I like traditional cinemas, and the Regent hasn't changed all that much over the years. It was actually there when the Marines were here, and a fact that people don't necessarily know, that's the last place that they gathered. So it was about the night before they left, mostly the main officers and quite a few of the others, they went to the Regent to say goodbye to the people of Masterton.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
Where they gave their farewell speeches. So to have the premiere of the film in the place where they basically were last, in the township
and
of Masterton.
And said thank you to the people of Masterton.
So that's
sort of
the last place they were before they went to camp and then went back into the Pacific War. To have it in exactly the same place, same theatre, that's very, very special.
Oh, it's just so much history and nostalgia in that building, isn't there? So that is really, really important. So we're screening at the Regent on Saturday the 24th of May, 4:15 matinee. We're happy to announce that we're going to do a repeat screening on Sunday at 7:15, Sunday the 25th of May at 7:15. So we're really pleased that we can do an afternoon matinee and a night screening just to capture as many people as possible who have shown a real interest in seeing this film. Absolutely encourage people to come and see this film. And tickets are available now through Regent 3 Cinemas. You can do a phone reservation, book online, walk in and get your tickets in person. You can also go through the Wairarapa Film Festival website, which is wifilmfest.co.nz. Mark, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you very much.